welcome to another episode of the Sawdust and Fire Podcast. We are your hosts. I am Hunter Johnson.
And I'm Thomas Baldridge.
Well, good morning, Thomas. Looks like we've made it through another week here. Weather's getting a little nicer.
Yeah, I could stand to use some rain.
Man, I'm starting to get the itch here. Some of these cool mornings, waking up and long shadows, and it's been kind of nice. I think the heat's coming back for a little bit, though.
Yeah, unfortunately, I've been wanting to either go try and shoot some squirrels or some doves, and I have yet to had an opportunity to do that, but it is the season.
Well, you know, they say a guy that doesn't have time to do some of that just too busy. But
well, that's probably the truth.
Man, I don't want to make much small talk this morning. I am fired up about this guest that we've got today. You know, when we were asked to do this, he was one of the first people that popped into mind. And I've got to tell you a story. So it's probably been 5 or 6 years ago now. To get our DMAP packets, we had to go to a meeting over at Brinkley at the office. And I was like, man, crap, I ain't got time for this. I don't want to go to no dang meeting to get our packet. Just mail it to us. But so anyway, I went to that. And that was the most fascinating meeting I've ever been to. And that is one of the things that fueled my desire to do all of this crap that I'm doing. Because before that, man, I was a stone cold killer. You know, you want big deer, you put out feeders, you grow a few food plots, and hey, magically supposed to have big deer, right?
Yeah.
And we go over to this meeting, and this joker is doing the standing up in front of us, and he's talking about, you know, if you want big deer, you need to start shooting some does. And I'm like, either he's a genius or he's lost his mind. And I even went around, I was working for Game and Fish at the time. So I started asking some of his coworkers, hey, man, what do you think about this guy? Is he the real deal or is he off his rocker? So, oh, no, if he's saying it, you can take it to the bank. It's the real deal. So, man, I am excited and I am fired up today to have this guest on, Bubba Groves. How you doing, Bubba?
Man, doing good. I appreciate that intro. And you know, man, I enjoy that presentation. Probably one of my favorite ones I've got. To do that. I wish that's all I did with Game and Fish, to be honest with you. It's a lot of fun and usually have a lot of fun with the crowd there, you know, with the deer hunters there with that. So I appreciate that, Hunter.
Man, I'm telling you, if, you know, we're friends and we talk back and forth on the phone and email and text messages, and I can ask you about anything I want anytime. But if you're giving a presentation and it's within a couple hours of me, I'm going. I'm not missing a Bubba Groves presentation. So I always got to hear what Bubba's going to say tonight. So
what would Bubba do?
So. What would Bubba do?
I think it should be a requirement that if you're buying a deer tag in Arkansas, that you have to go to Bubba's class. And if you're going to spray any chemicals, I don't care if it's Roundup or, you know, just your generic glyphosate or whatever, you have to go get your applicator's license, period.
Hey, take some of these things off my plate and I'll be glad to do it. So.
Oh, well, Bubba, tell us about yourself, where you got your, where you went to school at, where you got your knowledge and what you do for a living and what your day-to-day activities kind of consist of.
Yeah, man. So I'm Bubba Groves. Again, I work for the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission. I guess I kind of have a dual role as a private land biologist. So still work with landowners in four counties down in southeast Arkansas. And then I'm Ted Zvizlak's private land assistant coordinator of private lands. And that's what takes a lot of the time up is handling the admin side of the private land section. We cover about half the state, got five guys I supervise. So kind of a unique role, kind of a hybrid role where I do some of both. And that can be a challenge at times. But like I said, one of my favorite programs, we work with everything with landowners. All of our private land biologists, typically their role is to work with private landowners. We've got 10 of them stationed around the state, exciting times in our division. The director has unveiled the new strategic plan and his vision for us going forward. We're going to have a new division, our own division, come out of this. And hopefully that means more boots on the ground and capacity. Right now, 10 of us, we do the best we can. But we need more. We need more to really, really meet all the needs of all the landowners like we need to do. So hopefully that's coming around the corner, as we come down. But again, so what our guys do and gals is the landowner calls and says, hey, I want deer, turkey, quail, whatever it may be. They go out, do site visits and say, hey, here's Equip, here's Acres for Wildlife. If you want to do it on your own, hack and squirt, timber, whatever it may be, you know, we try to meet the landowner objectives with what they want and help them get there with wildlife. So, excuse me, that's kind of what we do on a daily basis. I guess about me, graduated from Mississippi State in 99, actually have a fisheries degree. So kind of well-rounded, worked on the, ran fish farms, catfish farms over in Mississippi for 10 years. And lo and behold, fell in love, got married, moved to Arkansas, didn't know what in the world I was going to do. And had this degree and enough forethought as a 18-year-old, or I guess a 20-year-old at Mississippi State to think, well, you know, I've probably got enough aquaculture experience that I don't need the piece of paper that says it. So I went and got a wildlife degree with a fishery science option. And still could do my aquaculture stuff. But when I got out, moved over here, it allowed me to put in for this job and got it. And so I have, and then sort of seen the fish world and now in the wildlife side of things. But real quick, one funny story. So came out of Mississippi State as a 21-year-old, or I guess about 22-year-old at that time when I got out. The football team was terrible. I think Arkansas State beat us that year, the year before. I mean, we were awful. And as a 22-year-old, you know, your whole world revolves around stupid things like football. And I thought, man, this degree's it ain't worth the paper it's written on. Football team sucks. Just kind of compared to that. And as I got into the fish world and started going to some of the conventions and things, man, everybody was, well, Mississippi State's doing a study on this, and all the professors I had. And then as I move over here in the deer program and the forestry program they had, it was like, man, Mississippi State's doing this research. And so now as I look back as a biologist and people like Steve Damaris, the presentation you're talking about, Hunter, I have to admit, I kind of poached a lot of it from Steve Damaris and Bronson over in that part from Mississippi State. But anyway, great program, great wildlife program. So graduated from there, moved here, and now I'm a private land biologist, Game and Fish Commission. So here I am, full circle. So.
Well, we are dang glad to have you here in the state of Arkansas. I know you've done wonders for everything that I manage, and Thomas, I think I can speak for him as well. And man, it's just, you're a blessing to have. We're fortunate with a lot of the resources that we have here in Arkansas for the betterment of our wildlife.
And hopefully, like I said, this new division that should allow us to take it to the next step. So,
yes, sir.
Good, exciting stuff. So.
Well, one of the things we want to talk about today is DMAP. I know a lot of states do it. Arkansas has had it for a while. Some states, I know Missouri just kind of recently started something, I think, and Mississippi's had it for a while. But what is DMAP?
Okay. Well, of course, it stands for Deer Management Assistance Program. It's one of the programs that our POBs administer around the state. So we've got, real quick, three levels of it. Levels 1, 2, and 3, kind of based off of the ages of the buck that you want to harvest. In my presentation that you talk about, we may get into this a little deeper down the line, not sure, but there's three primary factors that influence the size of antlers that you harvest as you're on your deer club. One is age, one is nutrition, and then one is genetics. Age is the most important one. If let deer get old enough, so say 4.5 to 5.5 years old for high-end type management, he certainly can't get big enough, right? He's not going to reach the potential if he does not get old. So that's one of the most important things is getting them old. So our DMAP program is based off level 1, which kind of just herd management. We give you some doe tags, not really a lot of buck management in on that. It's kind of state legal bucks. Level two moves into quality buck management, where we start taking deer at the age of 3.5, which is 1 year older than kind of just basic state management. But we're taking them at 3.5 years old. The biologist is collecting data. The hunter, the club collects data, gives it to us. We provide a report to you that shows, okay, so a certain percentage of your bucks were, you know, three and a half and older. So you're doing good. Or, you know, 15-20% of your bucks were less than the age of 3.5, your target age class. So, hey, we need to do something to kind of curb that. And there's ways to do it. And we kind of are club specific how we do that. But anyway, so that's level two. The level three is shooting bucks at the age of 4.5. We call that intensive management or trophy management. We're getting them to the basically their peak age class here in Arkansas. At 5.5, a buck is peaked out. In Arkansas, Mississippi, Louisiana, kind of this part of the world, 5.5, he is what he is. That's about where he's at. So we don't carry him to 5, we carry him to 4. He's about 90% of where he would be at 4.5 years old. So that's close enough. And so we kind of work with the clubs to collect data and try to get them there to shoot that.
Well, I know when I first got into DMAP, I was actually sitting on a stand 1 year. And I had already shot 2 or 3 does, and I was seeing several of them, and I thought, you know what? I didn't know what DMAP was. I didn't know there was such thing, and this was several years ago. But I was like, you know what? I'd like to shoot some more deer. I'm going to call my private lands biologist and try to convince him that they're eating their crops up and see if I can get some more doe tags. I'm going to pull the wool over their eyes so that I can shoot a few more does here. And then fast forward, and I go to this meeting, and I wasn't pulling the wool over anybody's eyes. That was my job, my responsibility. And I even heard the comment made, hey, if you're not willing to shoot your does for us, I don't know that we can really help you. And I'm like, I listened to that statement, and I'm like, wait a minute. This isn't a privilege to get to shoot these does. More or less, it's helping the whole greater picture. And I don't, you know, they want me to do this. So, you know, I'm gonna get a little more involved and shoot. They might let me shoot a few more. And I've heard you talk about stories of some people that just are lightly harvesting does on a property, and some people that are really intensively. I've even heard you mention a doe per 20 or 30 acres on some big 7,000 and 10,000 acre clubs. And man, that's like 300 or 400 doe a year. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay. So yeah, kind of going back to what we just said just a minute ago about it's a triangle. If I had the PowerPoint here to show you, it's kind of a triangle of the deer pyramid, I call it. We go back to genetics, age, and nutrition. So most people want to think about nutrition as, well, I got to plant food plots, or I got to go put feed out, these kind of things. Well, food plots are good for supplemental nutrition. Where you make your most bang for your buck is through your habitat management, through mainly timber harvest, those kind of things, or timber management, because you're talking about tons of food on the ground that you're putting just by getting sunlight there. And it's quality food. Most everything with sunlight that hits the ground is looking at 20% protein, 20 to 40. That's equal to or more than what protein pellets are coming out of a feeder. So you're getting more bang for your buck. It's cheaper. That's what deer want to eat. That's what their digestibility is set up for. Their systems are set up for. So that's where you get your bang for your buck. But what most people don't think about is kind of an indirect way of this is two things. To achieve better quality bucks, not only age, we got to get them older. We got to get them to 4.5, 5.5. The other side of that, on the nutrition side of things and the health side of it, is carrying capacity. How many deer do we have on the landscape? And we're not going to outfeed that. We're not going to outfood plot numbers of deer on the landscape. So what we want to do is we want to maintain our total deer herd below carrying capacity. And the better quality of bucks that we want to kill, so to speak, the farther we need to drive down our total population below carrying capacity, what we can possibly carry. And the way we do that is through doe harvest. So yeah, Hunter, as you mentioned, so I've got some quality deer management clubs that shoot 75 to 100 acres. All they're interested in is shooting a 3.5-year-old buck, just shooting good ones. They're not crying at me, well, I don't know why I don't have 180 class deer. That's not what their goal is. But a club that comes and says, hey, we want to shoot the biggest deer that this property can shoot. We're here to shoot trophy deer, deer that make the book in some cases. Some clubs are, that's what they're after. Well, we have to really drive that population down just because of resources, just all kinds of dynamics that go into that. But it goes into miles on the landscape. Well, a deer eats 7 to 10 pounds of browse or food a day. And in this the presentation Hunter's talking about, I bring a bucket out and I dump these leaves, 7 pounds of leaves, on a table that gives you a visual of how much that is. And the first time that I saw it, again, I poked some of this from Steve Damaris, Dr. Damaris and Bronson, Mississippi State. I actually towed it in to Rubbermaid and couldn't see it, but towed it in to Rubbermaid. It had soybeans in it, 7 pounds of them, and set it down. And Steve Damaris dumped those out. And I looked at that, and I mean, I was floored. Corey Gray, our deer coordinator at the time, told me what he was going to do. I knew he was fixing to dump them. Didn't know that's what was in the Rubbermaid, but I knew he was going to dump them, knew when he was going to dump them. He dumps it, and I was absolutely floored. You would be amazed at what 7 pounds of food is a day on a landscape. So every time you take a doe out, to shoot the doe. All we want is enough does on the population to sustain our population, to create button bucks for down the line. That's what we want. They're producers for our bucks for the future. So all we want is enough to sustain that. And so as we take those numbers down, you're adding back 7 pounds of browse on the landscape per day. So if you kill a deer on October 1st, kill a doe on October 1st, by October 31st, that's 210 pounds, theoretically, that you add back to the system. So the earlier you can shoot them, the better. Why tote these deer all the way through December, the rut? You run your bucks down chasing them and say, well, I don't want to shoot any till the rut. I want to let them rut, and then I'm going to shoot them. We got a lot of clubs that do this. So now you've let them eat all that food all the way through December, whenever it is, January. They've rutted, your bucks have wasted energy chasing them, then you go in and shoot them. You've wasted 2 months.
Right.
In the world, what I would like the clubs to do is come in on the first day of bow season, and we have doe tags that we can help meet this. That's what they're for, is to help the clubs reach these goals. Because we're telling, hey, look, you need to shoot, like you said, Hunter, it's a trophy management club. It's not unusual for me to tell you, hey, I need you to shoot, 50 deer per acre, 20 deer per acre. So in some cases, that's 400. We have unrestricted weapons tags through Game and Fish Commission to help facilitate this so that you can start shooting a rifle the first day of bow season. And we want you to do that. Go out there on the first day of bow season. If you see 5 does, kill all 5 of them. I know there's going to be some spotted fawns in there. That's fine. Their systems after about 2 weeks old are set up to eat vegetation. They're not going to starve to death. I know it's hard. They sit there and they look at you. You load mama up on the four wheeler, and they're looking. I've been there. My daughter even asked me one time, said, "What are they doing?" And I'm like, "Hey, Merchie, just get on the four wheeler and we're gonna get out of here." But it's what you need to do. The earlier you can shoot them, the better. It kind of lets, and then what it does, lets the wood settle down by the time the rut gets there. So now your does are back out doing what they do. Now the bucks start coming and they're not running all over each other trying to breed, trying to give, because all the does come in on the whatever day they generally come in within a week of each other. So they're going to come in. So all these bucks are fixing to run, and then if they don't, all of them don't get serviced on that first rut, you'll hear people talking about a second rut. Well, the reason that deer chasing the second rut, it's two reasons. One, either they did not get bred the first go-round, or it's a fawn or a year and a half old doe If they come in and you're looking at your year and a half, so about 50% of them will breed they'll be their second year, second winter. And fawns, once they reach 80 pounds, from what we heard at the NDA meeting a couple weeks ago, at 80 pounds, a fawn, can actually breed. So it's one of those. They're going to come in a little later than the older does. So that's okay. There's nothing we can do about that one when they're running, but what we don't want to have is a percent, 10-15% of the does that don't get bred the first go round, and they're having to get bred, the second time when they come in. They'll come in a third time if they don't get bred. So now you are absolutely running your bucks down. Tremendously. Put one more point out there, and I'll let Hunter go back in. So looking at data of what we collect. It's not uncommon come the, I'll say, the middle part of December, and a buck be harvested and he weighed 40 to 60, even 80 pounds less than what the same 4.5-year-old bucks weigh in October. So just redneck sort of way of thinking about this, and I'm sure it doesn't work physiologically this way, but just my redneck way of thinking. So that deer starts growing his next set of antlers when he sheds them in February. I know we don't see them until June and velvet and all that, but he's actually growing his next set of antlers in February when he sheds them. So we're sitting here in February, not the most plentiful time of year for food on the ground, but he's got to build back up that 40 pounds that he lost, that 80 pounds that he lost. He's got to build his body back up before he can dedicate full fit nutrition to growing antlers. So if we shoot our does on the front end and we don't run those bucks down that hard on the front end, then maybe he can devote more earlier to antler growth, and you'll see that on the back end the next year. So went around the world a bit. That's a lot. I mean, that's almost a whole presentation in about 5 minutes. So if I glossed over something a little bit too much, y'all let me know.
We're going to quiz you here because now – this contradicts what most deer hunters say, because I hear deer hunters say, my deer aren't starving. I can't see the ribs showing. My deer must be getting plenty of nutrition. And on the flip side, they're saying, now we're up here in the hills. We don't have the genetics like y'all have down in the Delta. We've got a bunch of little bitty deer up here in the hills. But now we have learned that there's good genetics and bad genetics in every herd. And they have the good and bad genetics up in the hills, just like we have the good and bad genetics in the Delta. The difference is they're probably getting a little more food in the Delta from some crops versus more early successional habitat growing in the woods and some of the hill ground. But we can even make those hill deer bigger and better by providing more nutrition in the form of early successional habitat and by shooting and reducing does. Yeah. And even in the Delta, I think this is just my theory, and you can correct me where I'm wrong, because, I say this in every presentation. We don't want to be right. We want to provide great information, truthful information. But there's not a lot of habitat work that goes on in these woodlots in the Delta. And if they are, they're more focused on ducks than they are deer in a lot of places. But it seems that crops get harvested September, October. And then, like this year, we stayed so wet here in the Delta that they didn't get soybeans planted until June, early July. So if you don't have that early successional habitat in the woods, if you haven't done some thinning and done some habitat work to put sunlight on the ground, those deer don't have a whole lot to eat from harvest until crops are planted and emerge enough that they can start providing some bedding and some forage and stuff like that. So we're really hurting ourselves, right? By not doing a little more. We could do more in both areas, I guess is what I'm saying. And then shooting does on top of that really, really increases that. The effects of that. But what do you say to people that say, I don't have big deer. My doe weights are 90 pounds and my bucks are, we struggle to get 120-inch bucks, But that's not going to help me because my deer aren't starving.
Well, you know, it's not necessarily an issue of starving. And we got into that last night at the meeting I was at. Guys, man, I don't put this corn out, you know, in February. Man, they're going to starve to death. No, they're not going to starve to death. If they were going to starve to death, they would have done that before we sailed over here with Christopher Columbus in 1492. I mean, they were fine before we got here. They're going to be fine after we get here. We're the ones that can mess it up. But no, the proper timber management, again, going back to what we said before, managing your habitat, that's where you're going to get your biggest bang for your buck, having browse out there all year long. Like I said, your blackberries, greenbrier, stump sprouts, you know, tips of certain plants and twigs and that kind of thing. That's what they're eating all year long. Again, that stuff is nutritious to them. You know, it's not as plentiful as it is sometimes of the year in different forbs and different plants. Yes, they're going to come and go. But it's not about them starving. You know, we're not having a problem with them starving to death here. What we're looking at is quality, the health of the herd. And again, even on basic management of DMAP, we're running those things right at carrying capacity because those people want to see a bunch of deer on the landscape. Right. That's okay. But still, we need to. They're still healthy. They've got twice as many or whatever it may be. I don't get into a lot of deer density numbers because I'm more of a club level focused. Our deer coordinators and them can probably give you some ideas on that around the state. But where my job is at a club level. So like I said, we don't get into this one's got twice as many as that, but we do know that we're not harvesting as many. So we've got more deer on the landscape there, but they're still in their health is okay. They're not in an unhealthy state or they're most cases. They're not, we see browse lines. You start seeing browse lines, where they're absolutely eating everything from the shoulders down. Now that may be a case where we are getting into some overpopulation, but again, feeding them is not going to get you out of that. You can't outfeed that. You're not going to outfood plot that. And to kind of dovetail back to what I said, so thinking about what I said a minute ago about doe harvest, that's your most consistent way to add food back to the landscape. If you know Bubba's going to tell you to shoot 100 does a year and you need to shoot 100 does a year, you're going to take that many out. Well, if you plant a food plot, what if you have a drought? What if army worms come in? What if a flood comes in? All these things can happen to you when you're trying to artificially feed or artificially put food on the landscape, where if you manage your herd down to what the numbers should be and keep them in a balanced situation, they can withstand snows, they can withstand floods, they can withstand droughts. Everything's okay. They may not be in tip-top shape all the time, but they will handle it if we keep them in order. And that's what we're aiming at through this DMAP program is really is herd health, the health of the herd, with kind of the icing on the cake is some antler management on the other end of it, if you will.
So, right. Well, Thomas,
I don't know. Hey, Hunter, real quick. I want to go back to something you mentioned there that's interesting that I do hear, and it was a heck of a presentation that I saw come out of Mississippi State, because I always heard that when I was in school is, well, the hills don't have genetics. You know, the mountains don't have genetics. The Delta, they kill big deer because they got the genetics. Well, the state of Arkansas, our deer got the genetics that they got. Some of them came from North Carolina back in the day, Wisconsin, wherever we brought them in from back in the 40s, 50s, and restocked those efforts, wherever that did. So that's the actual genetics we got or wherever they came from. But we got the genetics that we got. And so what you'll see is it goes back to dirt. And it's a 1,000-foot view. It goes back to dirt. The more productive the dirt is, the more productive the plants you have there that are healthier, more generally speaking, I guess I'd say more types of plants, more diversity. But the better soil health and the more productive the soil is, the more productive the plant is. The deer eats the more productive plant, i.e. now we've got healthier, bigger antlers, bigger bodies, that kind of thing. So it goes back to actually dirt, but it goes back to what they eat. So Mississippi State, not to tout them, but they actually came to my hunting club in the Delta in Mississippi in 2000, and they collected some deer. They collected some from the lower coastal plain down around Hattiesburg, I believe, but it would be comparable to our coastal plain in southern Arkansas. And maybe northeastern, I can't remember now, it's been too long ago, but I know they had two or three different populations of deer, and they put them in the deer pen. And so they had bucks all the way down to button bucks. And what they found was they brought the buck, like 3.5-year-old bucks that they got from the Delta and all those, they put them on the same food ration. Well, they started out the year before when they caught them. Of course, the Delta bucks are 140, whatever inches they are. The coastal plain bucks are 120, whatever they are. You know, there is a significant difference in antler size. They put them in the pen, gave them all the same food, and actually the deer from the coastal plain wound up bigger than the deer from the Delta did. And I think that's what they found really in the button bucks were the exact same way. Once they put them all on the same food, it was negligible the differences in antler growth. So it's not genetics. It doesn't have anything to do with genetics. It goes back to what kind of food and the quality of food that they have. And that's the limitation. So I've got coastal plain clubs. I tell them, hey, look, 140 inches is going to be your top end deer. That's as good as you're going to be able. Sure, you'll kill 160 every now and then. You're going to do that. But what we can expect to consistently kill is going to be a 140-inch deer and probably going to be somewhere between 120 and 140. A Delta club, we can get to 140 really easy. We're 140 to 160 in Delta, and it goes back to the dirt and habitat that they are there. And then, of course, like I said, then it's about getting carrying capacity down. How big do you want to go? You know, it's like picking a garden, man. It's like having a garden. You can let it weed up and you're not going to have very many tomatoes. You can go out there and you can hoe it, you can pick it, and you can do the things, fertilize it, do all those things. You'll pick a lot of tomatoes. So deer management's a lot the same way. The farther you want to take it and the more you want to get out of it, the more you're going to have to kind of put into it and work. And some of that is managing the population.
Well, let me try to head off something that I think I'm right about. You correct me if I'm not, but I bet we've got some listeners sitting here saying, well, you know, I'm in the hills and you know, he just said that, you know, 140-inch coastal plain deer is probably going to be about our max. So, you know, I'm seeing some 120s up here in these rocks. That's probably going to be about our max, but we can increase that by, you know, there's not a lot we can do in some of these bottomland hardwoods because they kind of are what they are. And, you know, we don't have slopes that can be thinned and restored back to savanna types and prairie types. But some of these guys that are in these hills are in the prairies and different things. By having some old field habitat, by doing some timber improvements, getting rid of some closed canopy, putting more sunlight on the ground, we can definitely increase the browse available there and the early successional plant communities, but they could probably all benefit, wouldn't you think, from doing some habitat work and taking some miles out of the herd, reducing their doe populations. Couldn't they probably see an improvement in most cases with the type of habitat that we see across the landscape these days?
Well, yeah, and I think from what I see with most properties that I go out on, most time you get there, there's a reason somebody called you, right? They want it to get better. So a lot of times they don't know what they should do. So a lot of times there's not a whole lot of management going on a property. Right. So whatever you're seeing now, if you're not doing any kind of, like I say, habitat management mainly, your quality food plots, bedding areas, like you mentioned, pollinator plots is what I call them, quail plots, but all prairie type fields, those kind of things. I actually learned now. I used to think 2 years ago when we were planting these things for quail, I was like, well, you know, deer bed up in them and they'll fall in them, and great fawning areas, by the way. But yeah, I thought, man, that, you know, it's probably what they're getting mostly out of. We went through a QDMA training this past year, and they were showing us what the food content was and the nutrition content of like black-eyed Susan, purple coneflower, all the sunflowers. I mean, the mix we're planting now has got 50 different flowering species in it. And then as we've gone through looking at quail, notice, man, here's my tick seed sunflower and the heads eat off of it. Here's my black eye Susan and the heads eat off of it. Like, hell, these damn deer are eating these things, you know. And anyway, so we go into this meeting this year, and yeah, sure enough, man, those forbs that we're planting, and all these things will come in timber management too. They're going to be there all summer, so you're getting a basically food plot in your timber. So if you're not doing any of that, yes, you're going to get gains out of that. You know, the more you do, the farther you take it, yes, you're going to see gains. Now, at some point, sure, you're going to top out just at, you know, where you're at, but you can be better than your neighbor because your habitat's better than him, by all means. And whatever you're doing, the more you can increase that, the better you're going to see those returns.
So, right.
Yeah. And I'd say this too, talking about the Delta, yeah, you know, a lot of the bottomland hardwoods, to me, they're a lot easier. They're pretty straightforward. You either thin them or they're already thinned or that, you know. And most of the time with hardwoods, we can get, you know, timber cutters there and do it commercially on a big enough track, kind of depending on where the mills are. But, man, just some good thinnings. And then, you know, kind of not to get long-winded on it, but, you know, what we saw, too, at the QDMA or the National Deer Alliance training, I think is what they are now, that we had, you know, I used to just think, man, I'll just thin sunlight on the ground, you know, vegetation comes up, we're good. You know, deer's a pretty easy animal, really. I mean, it's about as much of a generalist as we have in the state, and that's why we got so many. But, you know, they started kind of narrowing down almost like quail habitat, and it was pretty interesting to me, and I need to do some more research with this, but they were showing how, like with quail, we need brood habitat, we need nesting habitat, we need escape cover. And the quail, being as small as it is, they've got to have that. And that's why we don't have quail like we used to. But that they even tailored it down like that with deer. So, yeah, you know, a lot of times we come in and say, okay, this 40 acres, we're going to thin to 50 basal area, 60 basal area, and it's just a straight thin across there. Well, that's good. That's a heck of a lot better than being closed canopy and not doing anything. If that's what we can do and that's all we can get on there, I'm greatly satisfied. But they started showing that if you had openings in there inside of there as well, kind of some small clear cuts, if you will, that gives you bedding areas and kind of like the escape cover. And then it got into fawning cover. And then, so it was tailored more than just, hey, we're fixing to blanket a 60 basal area cut across this property. And then once you get out into there, so if you know that you've got these bedding areas, if you can provide sanctuaries, and with GPS collars now, one of the things that we're finding is deer movements and understanding that. But if you can on your club have a sanctuary where you never touch, those deer will figure that out. And they will stay there. So that's a way that you can, on a smaller acreage, especially, you know, a couple of 100, 200, 300 acre property, if you can take 50 acres and never touch it, have it as good a quality of habitat as you can, never touch it, catch them coming and going to it, but never touch that. That's something your neighbors don't have. The neighbors pressure them. They're going to come there, especially an older age class buck. At 3.5, they learn what they need to do to live. We've seen this on camera surveys. On Choctaw at 2.5, 1.5, we'll get that buck at all hours of the day, every day. He's like a 16-year-old kid driving down a 4-lane road and going through Sonic. You see him all day. At 3.5, he has learned that people are trying to kill me. And here is what I need to do to live. The dumb ones get killed. They get culled out. And the smart ones live and they figure it out. You know, so things like sanctuaries and those kind of things that can make a difference on your property over and above your neighbor's property. And what they told us too, again, kind of skipping around a little bit, apologize for that. But what they told us too that I thought was interesting. So say you got a 500 acre property, try to think of it in 50 acre blocks. You want to have everything in that 50 acre block. You want to have bedding area. You want to have, you know, I guess I hate to call it escape cover, but bedding areas, fallen areas. And then some open woods, kind of where you would hunt, you know, easy access, those kind of things. So just another thing that they told us. And going back to what I said about the deer movement. So what we what they showed us at that NDA training, again, is now they're starting to, you know, we've got deer with GPS collars on them, right? Somebody came in, I can't remember from Georgia or state, Mississippi State, who it was. Somebody came in and said, all right, let's put some GPSs on hunters. And it was like a permitted WMA hunt. So nobody can really be out there. There's probably some bow hunting or something, but really kind of limited access of those woods. So he got deer X, and they got it where he's been staying here the last 2 or 3 months in this place. And this hunter, he just happens to park here, and he goes in these woods. He goes in, well, deer that morning, it bumped him or something. He goes like 10 miles off the WMA, or maybe, I don't know where it was, but anyway, stayed 10 days off the WMA, and it took him 10 days to come back to that. He never came back to that spot for 10 days. So having these sanctuary areas and those kinds of things, hunter movements, and just like I say, just having a vegetation on the ground and thicker understory, midstory, if you will, deer are more comfortable with that. So if that's all we can do, we'll take it. You know, 60 basal area across the place, we'll take it. That's a heck of a lot better than wide open woods, because everybody uses UTVs, and I'm fat and short, and hell, I don't like to walk either. But nobody walks in anymore. So deer understand it's about survival for him. So when you think about keeping deer on your property, things like even more so than just food, the vegetation helps hold them there for comfort and safety, or whatever word I'm looking for there, but keeps them on your property rather than running off to the next property. So, anyway, went around the world there again.
Yep. When you say, you know, like on the sanctuaries, you know, never touch it kind of a deal. I just want to clarify this, that what you're talking about is keep human involvement and pressure out, but intensively manage it during the off season.
That's exactly right, Thomas. Exactly. You want to manage that. If anything, you probably want to manage that higher or better than you're doing the rest of your club, because that's where you want that deer to live, is in there, and have everything that he needs. Sooner or later, he's going to come out the rut somewhere. Even if he doesn't, he's going to stay there on your property. You kill him next year. And what we see with antlers, we talk about peeking out. Everybody said, you know, used to think, oh, when deer gets to 4.5, 5.5, I better kill him this year because he's going down. Man, with cameras and things, technology we've got today, it goes back to nutrition, what we talked about. The healthier, if that deer is in optimum health or as healthy as he needs to be, he will hold that out to 10, 11 years old in some cases. But they just get to a point and they flatline. So he is peaked, but he's not necessarily going down until his teeth wear too bad or whatever that may be. You know, habitat gets poor, younger bucks beating him up, whatever it may be. But he'll hold that. They'll hold that, basically that Boone and Crockett score, so to speak, within a few points or whatever. But they'll hold that out to in some cases 10 years old. So,
you know, there's a few things that always make me, I guess, not laugh in a negative way, but it's amusing. And one of those deals was in your presentation. I've been to a couple of them on your DMAP presentation, and one of them you were showing slides at, and there was a picture of closed canopy timber, and then the next slide was a thinned area. I can't remember if it had been burned or not, but showed a lot of native vegetation growing and, you know, a lot of good food for deer. And one of the guys in the back of the class raised his hand. I'll never forget this. And he said, "Where can I buy that seed?" And I was like, "Oh, me, let me answer." You know, yeah. I'm like, "Brother, it's there." And if you know, a lot of guys, the first thing they think about when they buy a property or lease a property is, "I've got to put in a food plot." And I love food plots. I'm not anti food plot. But you know, if you've got an 80 acre, 200 acre, whatever tract, and you think you're going to really change the world with a half acre, quarter acre, or 5 acre food plot, you're not moving the needle. Why not manage the entire property to be a food plot?
Yeah.
Look at all the ways you can do it. And then the other thing that always gets me And I kind of giggle because, you know, we've all had these conversations around the campfire at camp, you know, during deer season or, you know, while we're eating supper, and some of them can get pretty heated. But, you know, for years I heard, you don't need to shoot does. We don't need to shoot our does. If you were running cows, you wouldn't shoot all your heifers. But those same guys that are saying that have a cattle field that's overstocked, grazed to the ground, and they're supplemental feeding. And they fail to realize that an increased number of cattle does not mean you're increasing your yield and making more cow, you know, producing more cows. You can have, you know, healthier cattle that have higher daily weight gains by just not putting so many on that field. And deer are similar the same way. So why not take some of these things out? We're at a different period of our herd, at least in the state of Arkansas, than we were 20 or 40 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, when we were trying to establish deer herd, like you're talking about moving deer in and getting things going our way, you know, that was a different time period than we're in right now.
Right. Yeah. Think about what a great success story, right? We went from market hunting and those things back in 20s, 40s, whenever that was, almost shooting them out to extinction, right? There's no deer in Arkansas. I mean, I hear stories of people said if you saw a deer track, people would drive counties to go see a deer track, you know. And here we are, we did such a great job, and hunters were a part of this, you know. They withstood it and stood through it. You know, we protected does back in those days, doe days, no does, whatever it may be. Protected them, and that's what you had to do to build population. And you're exactly right, Thomas. Now we're on the flip side of that. We did such a great job of it. Now in most areas of the state, we're at that carry capacity, what I talked about. And so we actually need to start removing mouse, because if you think about what a doe does, you know, hopefully y'all have seen, I've got a lot of really good reports so far this year of fawn classes. Every doe, when she's bred in December, if you go and pull the reproductive tracts like we do with health checks, she's going to have twin fawns with them. 90 to 95% of all does that are pregnant have twin fawns. 90 to 95% of those will be a buck and a doe. So one doe turns into three total deer. Then that doe comes in the next year. So that doe has two more. So now you're up to, what is that, seven, wherever we're at there. So it's not really a one-to-one relationship where one doe produces one deer. It's an exponential relationship, because that female's doe the second year is going to produce one. So now she's producing three. The original is still producing three. So now three turns into six per year. So, man, it don't take long that they can outrun you. So that's what we see with the gnat outbreak down here we had several years ago. Took about 4 years, and they're back, flooding inside the Mississippi River levee. Even shooting them, like I said before, these clubs that are shooting 400 does on, you know, 8,000 acres, man, every year we're watching the ages, and, you know, we wanted to talk about jawbones. So the jawbone tells us everything. We want to shoot them down again, like I said before, where we've got enough stock of does to, you know, to keep producing our bucks for. Well, we know that once we get down to about, I guess the harvest is made up of about 60% of 3.5 and younger does, we're starting to get down into recruitment now. And that's when we want to go into a maintenance harvest. So that's kind of what the DMAP biologist does for you. It says, all right, hey, herd looks good. Herd doesn't, you know, shoot, hit the accelerator. Let's let off the accelerator. Most of the time in Arkansas, I really never have pumped the brakes much. We may let off the accelerator a little bit and then hit the accelerator. But collecting our jawbones and ages, without that, we're useless, basically, as your biologist. But that's where, Lord knows, and I forgot where I was going with all that. But anyway, that's what we're looking for, in how we know, you know, what to tell you to do is that way.
So, well, you know, one of my previous jobs, I had a boss, and it absolutely drove me crazy when he would say this, but he would say, you're only as good as your last report. Mm-hmm. It just offended me like crazy, because, I mean, you mean that all this work I've done before doesn't matter? You're just looking at my last report? But tell me what, you mentioned it, record keeping can do. I'm amazed that if I provide you, you can't undervalue the fact of putting boots on the ground at a certain place is indescribable what you can learn. But if I provide you with accurate quality data over a period of 3 years, let's say, or even five or less, whatever, I'm shocked at what you can look at that data and tell me about my deer herd. It's amazing. Talk about the importance of record keeping and what you can tell from it.
Okay. Well, like I said, kind of the record keeping is that's my, yes, that's our limiting factor as a biologist, right? I'm only as good as you. I can remember back in the Mississippi State days, I was there when Microsoft Word came out in the old computers. And I had a basic computer class, and I can remember the saying there, garbage in, garbage out. What you put into that computer was as good as you were going to get out of it. So that's kind of the way we are. If you give us, you know, half the jawbones you kill and you measure in half inch increments, man, I can't give you a reliable report out of that. So I need hunters to label their jawbones, clean them, accurately give them, don't get them mixed up. I see things that it's impossible. So somebody either mixed something up or did something, I don't know, but accurate data getting turned into me, what that does, like you said, Thomas, it gives you a snapshot of the last year. Okay. That's where I start at. Lactation rate, 71%. So I know the fawns were good, or reproduction was good the year before. Typically, if reproduction, you know, the lactation was good, that translate into high fawn classes. The jawbone, again, go back to what I said earlier. The higher the level of management we want to go, the farther we want to push below carrying capacity means we need to be burning powder and shooting deer. So I need to know where you stand and, you know, namely if something were to happen, when to hold up or when to slow down so we don't overshoot. Lord knows, I don't ever want to do that to a club. That's the worst thing that we could do is shoot out a club, if you will. But again, so what I'm looking at is the percentage of does less than the age of 3.5. And as long as we're at 60% or less of that age class of deer, man, we're fine. We can shoot them as about as hard as we want to in most places. So that part of the record keeping is on the doe side. So you think about the buck, again, go back to what I said at the very beginning. So if you're telling me, hey, I want to shoot, you know, just quality deer, all right, we're going to, what percentage of your bucks are 3.5 and older? Are you meeting that goal of what you said you wanted? 4.5 on trophy management, you know, what percentage are there? Had a club this year, man, they're trying to manage high end deer, kind of a double-edged sword. Well, they got in several years ago. We put some antler criteria on them to protect 3.5 years old. They did really good. It drove down the 3.5-year-old and less population of the bucks that they were harvesting. We were down like 5%. So what happened? They shot their does, did things good. Man, all of a sudden now your 3.5-year-old bucks are 140s, and they look good. Look as good as most anything that you've been looking at the last 20 years on that club. So, man, they get itchy. Well, they start itching back up, and they're itching back up. Now they're shooting 10, 20. 15, 20. And then this year they shot 50% of their bucks that were less than the age of 3.5 and less. And they have plateaued on their Boone and Crockett scores over the years. And that's why, because we're shooting down into that 3.5-year-old age class of your bucks. So they're not getting to that age. Well, first thing we talked about on here today, if they don't get old, they can't get big. And I told them in the meeting, you know, I'm not really one to come in and beat them over the head either. It's your club. It's your place. I'm here to tell you you're hurting yourself. If you want to try to fix it, I'll try to help, you know, with antler criteria and different ways that I've seen just personally, unique things, neat ways that clubs have addressed this. But at the end of the day, it's still that club's club. If they want to do that, that's fine. In this case, several of them, many of them were kids. And I want kids shooting deer. So that's why I don't come in with, you know, beating them over the head with a stick. I look at Polaroids of them, man. You got a 12-year-old there with a 140-inch, 3.5-year-old deer. Man, that was your 160-inch deer 2 years from now. But, man, that smile, you can't replace that smile on that kid's face. I've got a 12-year-old daughter, and, man, she is just as happy shooting a 7-point as she is shooting something else. So, and I want her to keep shooting. So, so we work with the club to address that, you know, hopefully. And like I said, I'm not going to beat any of them over the head, but I do want them to know, hey, you're hurting yourself, and I can't do that without clean data and good data. And then I'll take that to the next step. And usually those are tricky. Weights, man, those 2.5 and older, those weights can there's not a lot of variation in that. You can see a doe, a 2.5-year-old doe that weighs 115, 120 pounds, and you can see a 5.5-year-old doe that weighs 90. So there's once the doe gets to be about 2.5, weights kind of start becoming not as telling as some things. But what I like to track is Boone and Crockett scores. That's kind of a universal knowledge that hunters understand, and that they sometimes they think they know more than what they know as far as what 160-inch deer is, but they do know what we're talking about. It's something I can talk to them. And I talk lactation. When I talk this, man, you can see eyes glass over, but they understand Boone and Crockett score. So what I try to do is I track that over time, and what I want to see is we do things, whether it's timber harvest, doe harvest, those kind of things, is I know we go – typically, if a club calls me, they get a DMAP, they're wanting to shoot better deer, right? Want to kill better deer. Again, I've got some theory, just some kind of pie-in-the-sky goals or just some ideal goals that we want to get to, 140, 150. What I want to see is I want to see that club trend upwards over time. And then if that club kind of plateaus out by trending that over time and keeping up with those scores, that kind of tells me, hey, what's going on? Is it doe harvest? And then you go back and you trend your doe harvest per acre and your buck harvest per acre over time or in the ages of your buck. You can kind of take those three attributes and you start looking. All right. I want them to shoot more than a doe per 100 acres, but they're shooting a doe per 200. And they've done that the last 4 years. All right. When did they start plateauing out on Boone and Crockett score? All right. If both of them kind of plateau out at the same time, it probably tells you, and it's something that the club can really understand. And then that I get a lot of positive response out of that. So now they understand, okay, I see what he's doing here. I see why I need to shoot him. And so then I'll start shooting more. Or maybe that I don't usually ever want to shoot a buck for 200 acres more than that. That's kind of, we're shooting bucks in the batter's box for next year, usually once we start getting down below that or above that threshold. So it may be that they shot bucks really hard down 155 acres for 2 or 3 years. Maybe the age, like I mentioned a year ago, just a second ago, maybe that they're 15, 20% of their deer is at 3.5 and younger. So now we kind of hit a plateau because we're not getting enough of them in those older age classes. But I can't do any of that. I can't do nothing if the club doesn't collect me data. I'm useless. And that to me, in all honesty, good, clean data means way more to me, or is more important to me for recommendations than me ever stepping foot on the property. And hunters do not realize that. They think, man, you know where in the hell he can manage from a desk. Oh yeah, it is too. I can take lactation rates, ages, and Boone and Crockett scores and take some of those. And I can tell you a lot about your property just from here. Now, at some point, sure, yeah, you need to go out and look, talk habitat, just like we've done here. We need to get out there and do those things too, so we can increase that. But I can see a lot of things from that data that you give me, and the better.
I think it was interesting, you know, at the first meeting I went to that you did, that Kyle had, you know, really good record keeping, I think, on Doc's place for a number of years, and what you can just extrapolate from that. Even with that said, though, the two most common phrases that I think I hear out of every biologist I talk to is it depends. And then you've got closed canopy timber. You need to thin your timber. And then maybe third, burn something.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that shoot those. Now you can throw that in there too.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. That's right. Shoot
those. And I want to go back to what you said earlier, talking about the cows, because I've heard that before. And but you know, if those people that are saying that, think about it. So they've got a set number of cows in that pasture, right? Well, why don't, if it works that way that you don't shoot your cows, why don't you double it?
Right.
Why don't you double it? Why? I mean, if you've got 100, why don't you have 150? Now, it matters. The number of mouse you got out there on that pasture, that block of wood, the number of mouse matter. And that's the most important thing. And unfortunately, what people think is, like cows, well, I can just outfeed this. And with deer, you can't. And there's a lot of reasons why. We could spend a whole nother hour on another podcast talking about feeding versus not. But deer are not cows. That's one thing. And then they're not in the same setting. You're talking about a deer that's trying to survive, people shooting him, and cows standing up next to a feeder all day long that nobody's trying to shoot, that he ain't trying to live. You got him hemmed up in a fence. So there's a lot of differences between cattle and deer. That's not even a comparison there. So.
That's right. And I hear that comparison over and over and over again. And even though they make that comparison, I can argue the point that even if I allowed the comparison to go on, that, I mean, goodness gracious, it's pretty common sense. If you've got a 20 acre paddock with, 50 cows in there, and you're not supplemental feeding and you're not doing this and you're not doing that, then those cows are not going to be as healthy, gain as much weight as if you had 10 in there. And one thing you said in that meeting, I want to hear this too, about the supplemental feeding deal, mm-hmm. You know, and my answer is this: if you don't have an 18 wheeler showing up every week, full of stuff, you are not moving the needle.
Not moving the needle. Yeah. And I'll touch on that real quick. Again, we could probably get into feeding, and it don't take long to pass this to run outside my, cause I'm looking, like I say, club level stuff is where my expertise comes in. But listening to some guys out of Texas and other places. So feeding here, we get 55 inches of rain. Again, it goes back to soil. Our habitat quality is pretty good. It's pretty good in Arkansas, all across the state. Where feeding works, you're looking at kind of southwest part of Texas. You got rocks, sand, and cactus, right? So your native habitat, native vegetation is pretty lacking there. So yes, by you putting protein feed on the ground in that part of the world, you're moving the needle there, but just because it's not comparable to what's out there. The snowpack regions of Wisconsin, Michigan, places they get 24 inches of snow or so, at times of the year. Yeah, they can't get to anything. So yeah, protein feeding, it can work there. But guy said on a podcast from Texas, I believe he was a Mississippi State grad, actually. But what he said was that you're exactly right. If you're not feeding enough that you have to bring in an 18-wheeler load and offload it onto a tractor with an auger in the feeders, then you are not moving the needle. If you're putting it in by the sack, you're wasting money. And I hate to say wasting money. That's pretty hard. So let's say it this way. Instead of wasting money, let's say your resources, time, and money can be spent elsewhere doing something more important or something more beneficial than putting that protein feed in that feeder in the state of Arkansas. If you want to kill deer over corn, and that whole bait and feed, that's why in CWD zones, we didn't take it away during hunting season. It's a way of life in Arkansas. It is. It's a tool. I can't tell you how many hunting clubs I sit down with on a Saturday eating lunch and eating some dang good lunches with them. And I hear Tom down the way down here say, well, can't hunt stand so-and-so today. The feeder ran out on Friday. I'm like, man, have we gotten to this point? Mississippi, we're way behind. We just started feeding a couple of years ago. If we got to this point that if the sling feeder don't go off, I mean, we can't go sit in the stand. And we do. It's way of life in Arkansas, and it is what it is. So we want you to kill deer, and if it's a tool to kill deer, then let's use it for a tool to kill deer. Not necessarily. I think we're kind of missing the boat. We start talking about wanting to grow deer. That's a whole different ballgame there.
You know, Bubba, I think there was a study that came out of Texas where it looked at the cost analysis of feeding, supplemental feeding versus the cost analysis of a food plot and the tonnage that it produces, which I think hypothetically we can take that food plot there and spread that across the landscape in natives, and the cost tonnage of forage available, nutrition available, was so low on even planting a food plot or managing your timber and growing natives compared to supplemental feeding. I mean, supplemental feeding is expensive.
Yeah. I want to say, oh man, y'all run me out on a limb, and I'm good about running out on limbs and sawing them behind me. And I was trying to think of what it was per inch. I want to say I saw that in Alabama, but man, it was a lot. I mean, it was, I want to say it's like $100,000 an inch or something. That may have been from bringing, that may have been from genetics, though.
I think you might as well spend your money and get you a guided hunt somewhere else that's got them.
Right. Yeah. That, or like you said, you're better off, you know, man, plant you some quality food plots that are there all year, you know, winter plots, summer plots, whatever, you know, if you can plant clover that's kind of there all year, that kind of thing, you're way money ahead by managing your timber. Sometimes you can even, like I said, down here in the Delta, you can actually make some money off some timber. And so maybe a way to make some money on timber harvest, on your timber sale, then put that money back in your property and food plots, or, you know, native grasses, native vegetation. And, you know, in the benefit of the native vegetation versus a food plot, Thomas, like you're talking about, and again, we could go into a whole nother one about quail turkey. But when you're talking about nesting and ground nesting birds like turkeys, you're getting benefit out of that from them. Quail, those kind of things. I mean, that starts the basis of the food chain in those pollinator plots or those native grass plots. And everything benefits from a native grass plot where, you know, hey, wheat, hey, look, I'm like you said, plant it. Rather you do that than some other things, kill deer in it. This kill plot helps kill deer. Go plant wheat, go plant oats, whatever you like, and kill deer. But there are a lot of benefits, other benefits to having native grass plots. And again, managing your timber, there's nothing, no way around it. Managing your timber is the best way you can go. And that's for deer, that's for ducks. I mean, you look at our GTRs, canopy closed situations, that's not what we need in GTRs either. So managing your timber is the way to go. If you don't take nothing else out of this whole thing that Bubba says today, manage your timber. You can get a lot of things right if you manage your timber.
You know, if you care about anything from a butterfly or an insect all the way to deer,
all the way,
you manage that timber and you will benefit those animals. I know we're fixing to have to run because you've got some meetings coming up, and I'm sure Hunter wants to close this out. But I've got to brag on you just for a minute. And you and Ted and AGFC, I know y'all catch a lot of grief because, you know, we as hunters are passionate about hunting. We're passionate about this. So a lot of times, you know, our passion comes across a certain way, and sometimes that's not in the best light. But I'm going to tell y'all, you know, I was fortunate to receive an award this past year, and that may bias my opinion some. I don't think so, but I took my dad with me and my mom to that banquet. And my dad was blown away. He's 72 years old here in a couple months. He was blown away. My mom was blown away by the other award recipients there and the actions that Game and Fish are doing on private lands, on the landscape. And my dad and mom walked out of there and said, I had no idea. I've been around Game and Fish my entire life, and they are of the generation that saw the deer track and everybody came to look at it. And they said, I had no idea that Game and Fish was doing any of these kinds of things, from streamside management all the way to, you know, upland habitat work, terrestrial stuff. They were blown away. And my parents both said, this, what they're doing on private lands is the best kept secret in the state of Arkansas. And if people knew what they were doing, it would drastically change their opinion of Game and Fish's efforts. And I applaud Austin you know, in recognizing that and trying to put more of an influence, because, you know, what's public ground in Arkansas? 6 to 10% probably.
Yeah, I think so.
And if we're really going to move the needle across the landscape and get things back to where they were, private lands has to play a role.
Yeah. Well, first, Thomas, I appreciate that. I do. And you know, you said something there, a couple things, said something that, you know, I run into people and I battle people at times and people call. Part of that, the good side is people are passionate and they care here in Arkansas. If they didn't care, then they wouldn't care. I can't fix not caring. I can't. I stand no chance in fixing not caring. And that's part of, you know, it's not really people not caring now. It's people that don't know. And I can't hurt everybody. But if people have passion and they're willing to learn and willing to listen, hey, if you don't take the 10% of what I talked to you today, take 10%. All right, that's a win. Then we'll talk again in a year or two. If you take 10% and we'll debate it. Hey, I learned from y'all too. I got to have good landowners. Where do you think I'm learning about pollinators and deer eating them? It's on my landowners out there.
Right.
That, you know, so it's a two-way street. It is. And, but I really enjoy the passion. Most of the time, I mean, like 99% of the time, we can find middle ground. You know, we talk about 80%. You know, we're going to agree on 80% of it and 20% we won't. Let's don't focus on that 20%. Let's focus on that 80, and right. We'll work on that 20. But most of the time, that's what we once people calm down, and if I get wound up and I calm down, and you think about it, you know, he's got a point, yep. Or she's got a point. Yep. Let's start there. Right. let's start there. And so most of the time we do, but that passion, and I think just in Hunter, let's come in here. Because I don't want to forget this. So almost, you know, it's funny. What we talked about today is habitat management. Kind of most places are kind of at a ceiling. That's kind of where our staff was and where we were before, you know, before this division. We were kind of at a ceiling. I mean, we're running and gunning the best we can, doing the best we can. But now we're almost fixing to do kind of like a timber cut in the private land section. We're fixing right. To cut loose. And then hopefully the balls fall the way that we hope they do. We're fixing to take it to the next level, just like some of these clubs that we talked about. So it's kind of neat, kind of a correlation there between the two.
Hey, Hunter, before you jump in here, let me say this and I'll quit because we got to go. But, you know, Hunter and I talk about this a lot. Sometimes he goes back and re-listens to podcasts because there was so much info there. He's like, man, I got to get that again. And I'm always amazed. We relate this sometimes to church that you can have 200 people sitting in church and the preacher preach one message and everybody out there seems like got something different out of it. And that's why I like coming to your classes. Cause every time, even though I've heard it, sometimes it, you know, man, maybe I'm just slow, but sometimes it takes me time to hear and to understand and to keep hearing it.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly right. And I mean, that's a great analogy about church. Me and my wife go sit in church and I walk out talking about something. She walks out like, what are you talking about? we go to the grocery store and do that. Right.
But that's right.
But yeah, no, that's a great analogy. And you know, the beauty of it too, is like Hunter's talking about, what was it 4 years ago? I came and talked and man, we've seen different things come out that, man, the study with GPS collars now that are going on at Georgia, Mississippi State, and wherever else they're doing these things. We're always learning. It's CWD. We're always learning things. We probably need to do these things at least every couple of years just because we know new things, you know, at that point. So, yeah, good point.
Hey, I got to make you throw it in reverse. We got to back up for just a minute before I can let anybody go. We didn't talk about, and I know you kind of touched on it. I picked that up, but I don't think our listeners did. Which doe do you shoot? How do we know how many doe we should shoot? And I constantly hear people say, my buck to doe ratio isn't off. I don't need to shoot doe. So let's touch on that just a little bit. So which doe do you shoot? You're in a stand. Which doe do you shoot?
All right, so here's Bubba's logic. So I'm sitting there in the stand, and two does walk out. Or we'll say five does walk out. And I got five does sitting under a persimmon tree, and I'm going to shoot one. What I'd rather you do is take the oldest one, whatever you think is the oldest doe. Now, again, kind of like weights, once they get to be about past 2.5, if there's somebody touting that they can age a doe on the hoof past 2.5, they're probably lying. But what you can look at, if you've got several of them out there, is you can, cartilage never quits growing. So lengths of snouts, ears, mine are getting bigger as I'm getting older. But those kind of things, but you got to have several of them out there to kind of compare to. Don't get down in the weeds. Just pick out one you think is the oldest, probably the biggest. Pick that one out and shoot it. If they all four stand there, do the same thing again with all four of them and shoot that one. And if all three of them are still standing there, go ahead and get that one, the next biggest one, and go ahead and work yourself on down. And, I hate to say it, but it's okay. You know, what we're looking at, if that less than 3.5 age group, the doe's less than 3.5, what I'm needing is a sample size, right? So just like when I take a minnow net down there and I'm going to see what my average size fish is, I don't just pick out the biggest ones or ones I think are the oldest. I take that net and I go down there and count them out and I weigh them. So I need an actual sample size. So it's okay to shoot fawns. What we don't want to do with a fawn is shoot a button buck. At all costs, let's don't shoot button bucks. So if you're not sure if it's a button buck or not, let it go. I'd rather you let it go. But it's okay. It's okay to shoot yearling deer. It's okay. At the end of the day, the most important thing is if Bubba tells you to shoot 100 does or 40 does or 10 does, is to get to that number and get to it as quick as you can. Again, going back, we don't need to carry them to February and start shooting. That's not the ideal scenario. So that at the end of the day, it's a number. Get the oldest ones if you can. Like a buck peaks out at 5.5, 4.5, 5.5, and a doe is peaked out at 3.5, 4.5. She's a breeding machine at 3.5 and 4.5. After she gets to 5.5, she's kind of getting past her way there. So we always want younger deer, healthier deer. They can handle EHD diseases, whatever it may be that life throws at them. So we want to shoot the number of deer that's recommended, the older one if you can, and then and hit the number and as soon as you can.
So how do we know how many doe to shoot and if we've shot too many?
So going back to kind of what I said, if you're not in DMAP, I would usually recommend shooting twice as many does as bucks. Bucks are going to die. You know, you go back to, well, I'm at 1-to-1. Well, how do you know? If you're not doing a camera survey, bucks are going to be more reclusive than does. Just because people aren't hunting them, does, they're going to be more reclusive. You don't know if you're not doing an accurate in a camera survey based off of about a camera per 150 acres. Once we start getting outside of that, there's some extrapolations that you can do, but man, I would 100 to 150 acres per camera. If you're doing it there, that gets you pretty accurate. But if you got your DMAP biologist, you got ahead of yourself. So what I tell people that aren't in DMAP is usually you want to shoot about a doe, twice as many does as a buck. And then you want to stick somewhere around probably at least a doe per 100 acres. What I have seen through looking at DMAP data, especially my corner of the state, shooting a doe per 100 acres probably kind of breaks you even on what you know, taking deer out versus adding deer to the population. So that's kind of your break even point. If you've seen a whole bunch of them, you may want to get out about a doe 75, something like that. But again, the best thing to do, and we've got some parameters, you know, we're not probably going to take a 50 acre club and DMAP. We got to have enough acreage or enough property that we can manage a whole deer herd. If 100 acres, you're at the mercy a lot of times of what your neighbor's doing, rather than more so than what I can provide recommendation to help you for. So, you know, we'd want to be careful there. There's instances where we do take lower acreage clubs. But if you got your DMAP biologist, again, what we're looking at is that percentage of does less than the age of 3.5. And once we push it up to about 60%, then we'll start letting off the gas. If fawn lactation rates look really bad, we may actually let off. Generally, we don't ever say, oh, don't kill any. Don't kill none. We go to more of a maintenance harvest. And my maintenance harvest is a doe per 100 acres, kind of like I said before. And that's why, because we're not really taking out. We're not really adding to. We're just kind of maintaining status quo there. So
if we're shooting and we're aging jawbones at the end of the season, and most of the does we're shooting, 60% or more, are in the older age class, meaning 3.5 years or older, we continue doing what we're doing. But if we ever shoot down into that lower age class and more than 50% of them or whatever the number may be is younger than 3.5, we might back off a little
bit. Might back off. You might back off a little bit. Because like I said, what you're doing now, you're starting to get into that recruitment. That's your does coming up to that we want to be producing fawns for the next few years. So it kind of, you start getting a majority less than age of 3.5. That's when we kind of start going into a more of a maintenance harvest. Like I said, we don't stop. We still shoot some. And it's kind of a hard number. We talk about trends. When I came into Game and Fish, I thought, man, I'm going to trend this out. I'm going to show these boneheads and these hunting clubs that, how that number is going to go down because we're shooting more and Boone and Crockett score is going to go up. Well, that was a great idea in theory, but after I got to massaging numbers around a couple of years, man, it was all over the board. So what you have is some years you got bumper fawn crops, some years you don't. Well, as that thing yo-yos, that percentage is just going to yo-yo. So what you have to look at it, it's a threshold number. You're there this year, you're not that year. Don't worry about if it was 40, if it's 30, if it's 50, 60. Don't worry about the trend of it because your fawn classes dictate a lot of that. 5, 6, 7, 8 fawn classes in a row, and you can't get there. You can't shoot that many of them. You ain't got enough people to shoot that many of them. So just a threshold number, and once you if that's the number is 150, whatever it is, hit that number. That's what we need you to get to.
So. Right. You mentioned something earlier, like some general rule of thumbs, which, I think we all – always get a little nervous about giving somebody a general rule of thumb because it's really important to look at, a certain property. And the frustrating thing for me is, when I have somebody who says, well, I'm really good at aging deer on the hoof and in fact, they're really not, or they are analyzing their own jawbones and not submitting data. I don't have confidence in that, where RPOBs look at hundreds and hundreds, not only the training that they got to get there, but they're looking at hundreds and hundreds of jawbones every year.
Yeah, thousands.
Yeah, thousands.
In some cases, I'm fortunate here in the south and the eastern part of the state. We got some clubs that'll kill them. But you get up to other parts and, smaller clubs and some of that, it's hundreds for everybody. But, I think at one time I aged over 2,000 at one time earlier in my career when I had 100 clubs. So, man, you get tired of looking at them at times.
Bubba, we know you've got another engagement you got to get to. If you would have give us that fellow's name and number, we'd have called him and canceled that for you so we could keep you here. But anyway, I guess we better wrap this up, man. This has been a phenomenal podcast, and we're gonna have you on again because I've got a list of notes here that we talked about that I would have loved to have covered in this, and we could just start chasing rabbits on all these little topics. But I appreciate you coming on. Thank you for your time. And we're going to have to definitely do this again.
Yeah. Loved it. Love to do it again. And even if get some of my other POBs involved with some of it, maybe two of us get on, talk about burning, prescribed burn associations and some of the other things in the other corner of the state, whatever. I mean, like I said, we got more than several different topics we could do this on. So I appreciate y'all having me on, and I enjoyed every bit of it. I'm fixing to actually go and work on a youth shooting sports deal with kids all weekend through Quail Forever chapter here. And I think we got about at least 60 signed up. So, man, excited about that. See these kids out here. Let them burn some powder this weekend.
Yes, sir. That is phenomenal. Yeah. Well, Bubba, we appreciate you. Till next time, thank you all for listening to us this week. We'll see you next week on Sawdust and Fire.